Good afternoon. My name is Jim Atwood. As president of the Harvard Law School Forum, I'd like to welcome you all to this, our second program of the spring 1985 season. It's an afternoon program. I'm glad you all could make it here after class. A word or two about our format today. It's the forum's traditional format, after of ABC World News Tonight. But you may not know that he has had quite a long and distinguished career in broadcast journalism. He started out with the Canadian Television Network and moved to ABC in the mid-60s, spending much time in the field after that point. We were just told at lunch that he has visited now 91 countries, but his list of accomplishments as a field correspondent on national level is truly impressive. He was reporting from Beirut during many of the Middle Eastern conflicts and was there when the most recent Israeli incursion took place. He spent 6 or 7 years in London as the foreign anchor desk of ABC News, covering such world events as the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the attempted assassinations of John Paul II and President Reagan, and also giving the British perspective on the Falklands War. In 1983 alone, for example, he covered Pope John Paul II's historic trip to Poland, the aftermath of the U.S. Embassy bombing in Beirut, and the Ariel Sharon conflict following the Israeli incursion into Lebanon. In 1984, he returned to this country to anchor ABC World News Tonight. But we sense that the bug of field work is still with him, because just recently, he returned to Poland to cover the 40th anniversary of the dreaded death camp Auschwitz. He has also covered such interesting things as the U.S. elections and the inaugural. But I think I should let him tell you more about what he's done than me. So without further ado, please welcome Peter Jennings.
Glad you thought the election was interesting. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for inviting me. I am flattered. I hope I'm as flattered as you think I should be. And it's true that once I have had the benefit of your wisdom, I will have to go back to the mundane matters of doing a nightly broadcast in New York. I was looking at the schedule. Rather glad I got here before Mike Wallace. I know also that the first choice for the beginning of the spring schedule was actually Henry Kissinger. But I'm not sure you're aware that he was out taking a walk the other day, and he was hit by a speedboat. I hope you are faster than that in the courtroom. As Jim points out, I have now been back about a year and a half, I think it is. It sometimes seems like no time at all, and it sometimes seems forever. But it has been a fascinating year. I was listening to Geraldine Ferraro the other night saying how the year had had an impact on her. And she describes Walter Mondale calling her up and saying, "Hey, how'd you like to be vice president?" And she said, "You're kidding." And he was. She's a wonderful woman. She learned a great deal this year. Among other things, that she owed the IRS $153,000. That when Governor Cuomo told her that she should concentrate on the family, it was his and hers that he had in mind. I wonder if you will recall that towards the end of the campaign, we had great difficulty in journalism because we weren't quite sure how to deal with this phenomenon of essentially fundamentalist or conservative politics and religion. You will recall that Walter Mondale said in some desperation towards the end of the campaign, God has no place in politics. Well, we know at the end of this year, of course, that God feels the same way about Walter Mondale. I am, to say the least, somewhat self-conscious about appearing before, I gather, a fairly large contingent of would-be lawyers, and some, thank goodness, undergraduates. And not that I expect to fool you any more than I shall the lawyers. To be here, I haven't been here since 68 when I covered the bust. And as I was coming up this morning, I was thinking about the need in your would-be profession to be precise. We also have to be precise, not so much just with the facts, but with the words. And I was thinking of a great Bill Sapphire story who talks about Noah Webster of dictionary fame sitting in his office one day with his secretary on his lap. And his wife suddenly opened the door and she said, Noah, I'm surprised. He said, no, my dear, we are surprised. You are astonished. I stole it from him, as I trust you will steal it from me. What I want to do today is to talk about something in fairly unsophisticated terms, I think you'll come to realize fairly quickly, about something that's been very much on my mind. Jim pointed out that I spent much of my career overseas. I spent a fair amount of it covering Eastern and Central Europe, and I spent much more of it covering the Middle East. So if I have any specialty in the last 15 or 20 years, it really is the Middle East. But I don't want to talk about the Middle East. I want to talk about Soviet-American affairs, because I have become even more conscious since coming back to the country that there is a genuine lack of interest in America in what sort of nation our principal adversary is, what its problems in the modern world are, and what its perceptions are of us. I don't think at any time in post-World War II history has the phrase, know thine enemy, been more applicable and had a greater need behind it than it does now. I suppose I should start by asking the obvious question, why should we pay more attention than we do today? Well, because our survival depends on it, because it is up to us as citizens of this country and the free world to define, basically, what sort of a relationship it is we want to have with the other superpower. Because, though we sometimes forget it as we bemoan our distance from our politicians in Washington, we all do, in fact, share in deciding what sort of behavior we will accept from the Soviet Union in various parts of the world, and because we must decide what price we are prepared to pay, both at home and overseas, to protect American interests. Now, you hear an awful lot these days about how decadent the Soviet Union is and how its decline into shambles is, if not imminent, likely to come fairly quickly. I think it is very overstated. There's no doubt, I think, in our country that for the most part Americans are enjoying a rise in their fortunes. But this other superpower we are dealing with and trying to understand despite all of the obstacles is not some pipsqueak nation. Now, we all carry cultural baggage and political baggage in our minds about what sort of a nation the Soviet Union is. Just think about them for a little while. If you are a recent emigre from the Soviet Union, and you've come here and you've had some impact on the body politic in America, you clearly see the Soviet Union as a police state. If you're a diplomat or you're a bureaucrat, you see it as an enormous bureaucracy with which you're trying to do business. If you're a businessman, you see the Soviet Union as a group of hard-headed, very tough businessmen with which you have to deal on the international level. If you're a military man, you perhaps have a tendency to see the Reds are coming. All of those various perceptions impact on all of us every day, very often through the American media. Now, I want to begin or at least hasten to add right here that I think the American media in general has done a very bad job of exploring the Soviet Union. And we have done a very bad job of breaking out of the perceptions that we have grown up with, that it is the constant bad guy. I think we have to do it, and I think you have to do it, and we must try to do it together. Let me try to sketch very briefly and in a very general way and in part what sort of a country I think it is we're dealing with. A very proud people. Just listen to their students. I don't know if you've had any contact with your opposite numbers in the Soviet Union. But they now belong to a generation which realizes that their country has reached superpower status. And listen to them say, as I have done, that whatever the consequences at home, it is a status they intend to keep. It is a nation today where survival is much more important than the continuing revolution, where its leadership is interested, I think, much more in preservation than in transformation. The pure communist state has yet to come into being and may never. Yuri Andropov is only the most recent Soviet leader to acknowledge that what the Soviet Union is still going through is a middle, if not early middle stage of socialism, and has not by any means reached the epitome of the communist state. For the average Soviet man and woman, often very cynical, membership in the Communist Party is really an opportunity to share in the perks of the society. It means a car, it means an apartment, it can mean an opportunity to travel. And for many Soviet citizens, perks are of a much greater value than any commitment to the worldwide revolution which many of our politicians speak of. For the politically ambitious, of course, membership in the Communist Party is almost an absolute must. It is a nation, and you've heard it before, and it should come as no surprise to you, which has a deep and abiding passion for security, which clearly does border almost on paranoia. And all it does take is a visit to Leningrad, to what the Soviets call the monument to the Great Patriotic War, to see first the edification of the 20 million people that the Soviets lost in the war with the Nazis, but also to understand, even more importantly, that every succeeding generation of Soviet politician, and certainly every Soviet teacher, is going to ingrain in his student or in his body politic just as deeply as they can a suspicion of foreigners. How do you see that if you're a visitor to the Soviet Union? Well, you see it on television, among other things. Hardly an evening passes in the Soviet Union without some reference to the Great Patriotic War. It is a constant repetition inside Soviet society of why we, the Soviet citizens, should be suspicious of people from the outside. Now, it's a very difficult thing for us to, first of all, break through that, though Charles Wick, the present director of the United States Information Agency, is now going to try to do some of that by broadcasting directly via satellite to the Soviet Union. This will make the Soviets react in some ways, perhaps not directly to us, but in having to, in a sense, fight its own educational battle with whatever it is we beam to the Soviet Union. But imagine how difficult it is for us to imagine where they would begin if you are dealing with a Soviet leadership which has so little experience in the outside world except in the time of war. Yuri Andropov, you will recall, who was the General Secretary of the Communist Party, had traveled only in the Communist bloc. Brezhnev and Khrushchev and Stalin had traveled only as heads of state, and you particularly as students will understand that is no way to see the world. Recall the excitement and the curiosity when Mr. Gorbachev came not long ago to London speaking English and with a very attractive wife. He was actually compared in the British press to John F. Kennedy because there was such a hunger outside for us to have some experience with Soviet leaders who, as I point out, have had such limited experience with us. I remember not too long ago having the opportunity to sit down with a Soviet scholar who advises the Politburo. It was at the time of the Greyhound bus strike in the country. I don't know if you remember, but he knew precisely everything there was to know about the strike. He knew what the workers' demands were, he knew the bus schedules, he knew the towns and communities all across the country, what had been affected, but he didn't have, in any way, shape, or form, any comprehension. And it is very rare you encounter this level of comprehension of what we can call the American psyche or the American soul. Talk to any Soviet scholar who visits these shores, and I think you will find that a fear of the Soviet Empire dissolving is of far greater importance to him and far more likely to have an impact on the Soviet psyche than any ambition for freedom in the Western democratic sense. Talk to people, students, the unemployed, the employed, unemployed not in the literal sense, as there is no unemployment in the Soviet Union, on the streets of a Soviet city, and it is possible, about the freedom to speak and to write and to travel, and you will still very often find that housing and education and physical wherewithal, so long denied to many of the Soviet peoples, is much more important. We have a tendency in this country to imply that the Soviet leadership has failed its people. Well, in many ways, and certainly in our terms, the failure is dramatic. But many of the Soviet promises by the leadership to the people have been kept. They do live today with national security. They do live today with domestic law and order. They do live today with cradle-to-grave welfare. And they do live with an increasing improvement in material life in very general terms for each succeeding generation since the revolution. Think for a moment how you might have felt had you been a Soviet athlete on the eve of coming to Los Angeles, and in your government-censored newspapers, you had heard and seen all of the anti-Soviet behavior of those groups and crowds in Los Angeles. Imagine, and it is difficult, as we live so freely, what it is like to live daily with a portrait of America that is drawn in a Soviet-censored, heavily censored press. The Soviet media is indeed much more than one-dimensional, but they do for us what we do for them, essentially pick the worst in our society to show their people, as we intend or tend to pick the worst in their society to show to ours. Now, there is, of course, a built-in cynicism in much of Soviet society. Many people who see the United States so savaged by the government officialdom that they automatically believe the opposite. But bear in mind that even Russians, with the stature of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, however much they may have rebelled against communism, have, having spent time in this country, been turned off by what they regard as the excesses of democracy. Seth Meidens of the New York Times writes a fascinating article some many months ago now, but something that I'd never heard of before and was unaware of, called Toshka, which I'm told literally translated means homesickness. And add up, as I've tried to do, the number of Soviets who've lived here in what we regard the cradle of everything, who've decided to go home. Perhaps the most obvious one is Stalin's daughter, Svetlana Aleluyeva. Imagine what it is like for a Soviet citizen to have everything that we believe in available to them in every imaginable, conceivable way, and want to go home. How could one have homesickness, we might generally ask ourselves, for such a society? I don't mean to suggest, by the way, that there are no true believers in a pluralist society in the Soviet Union. Even Nikita Khrushchev, who was voted out of power 20 years ago, is said to have gone home, thrown his briefcase into the corner, and muttered, "I really did make a difference. They voted to fire me, whereas in Stalin's day, they simply would have had me arrested." I mentioned security. The Soviet Union's passion for security obviously extends well beyond border security. We see it in Soviet arms for Syria, Soviet arms for Libya, Soviet arms for Cuba, and Soviet arms for Nicaragua. But we forget that, to some extent, that Soviet intentions here are based just as much on Soviet determination to balance, in the end of the Brezhnev period, where possible, American strategic interest. This is a superpower at the work, having picked up what some people call Kissinger's belief in regionalism or in regional power. The consequences of Soviet assistance in the developing world are still, to this day, by and large, not the model by which most people would prefer to live in the post-revolutionary period. But we tend to forget, and I think we are seeing some of it in Central America today, how attractive socialism is to any nation or any group in any nation which has lived for any lengthy period of time under colonial rule. We should not forget that though America is often the model of development and aid, the Soviet model is not one that can be disregarded all the time. And when the Soviets get a foothold in the developing world, it appears to make them very proud. And as best we can tell, I think to give them one measure by which they can convince themselves of their relevance in the international community. How do we understand that better? Simply, I think, by trying to put ourselves, however distasteful it is, into the shoes of the other man. Most Soviets I read, and certainly most I speak to, seem to generally believe that their intentions in Afghanistan are similar to what ours were in Grenada. They already had an investment in a Soviet-supported coup in the Afghan government. They had trouble in an annoying Islamic neighbor on the borders of a country which already has an enormous growth in its own Muslim population and which at least Russians, who continue to control the heartland of the country, will consider as uncertain. What they didn't have, of course, was any sense of the cosmic reaction by the Reagan administration. Their expulsion from Egypt, when Anwar Sadat was president, Mrs. Sadat may talk to you about this, was, I think, one of the great setbacks they've felt they suffered, let alone suffered, in post-war policy. And they have spent all of their time and much of their effort in the Middle East ever since trying to get themselves back in. But when the nation is, as Afghanistan is, on the Soviet border, it does pay for us to remember, if not to tolerate, that from the Soviet point of view, there can never be too much security. Now, the notion that the Soviet Union can be brought to its knees seems to be not only naive, but dangerous. We heard a lot about it during the campaign this year. There is not, as far as I can tell, a shred of evidence to suggest that using economic pressure, which is the means very often suggested, does anything but drive the Soviets to greater military equality. This is not the first time the Soviet people have had to suffer for their nation's destiny. You also hear voices raised fairly constantly in the highest levels of government in this country which suggest that somehow we should make an all-out effort to free the Soviet Union's allies from communism. We heard it most recently from President Reagan on the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Yalta Agreement, when the president said again, as every president had said before him, you know, we will not accept a divided Europe and we will not accept an Eastern Europe under Soviet domination. We have to keep reminding ourselves that we do not have the leverage to do anything about it. In 1956 in Hungary, in 1968 in Czechoslovakia, in the final analysis, what we gave the Hungarians and the Czechs, and they remain outspoken on the subject, was little more than sympathy. We were very quick in this country to embrace Lech Wałęsa and the solidarity movement in Poland. But in the long run, I think all we really did, particularly because in our American way we so focused on the personality, as we focus on the Politburo's personality, was to convince the Polish authorities in the long run that solidarity was a tool at the very least of the AFL-CIO and perhaps of the Reagan administration. When Poland was denied credits by Washington and other economic sanctions were imposed, I think we succeeded only in pushing the Polish government deeper and reluctantly inside the Soviet sphere. It is true that we won with readmission of Poland to the International Monetary Fund sanctions, or should I say the lifting of sanctions, the amnesty on many political prisoners in the country. But I question how long lasting it really is. The Hungarian foreign minister dragged me into a corner at a party not too very long ago and said, much to my surprise, I wish you wouldn't pay so much attention to my country. I said, what do you mind? He said, did you hear that speech George Bush made in Vienna? I said, you mean the one where he said you were our favorite communist country? That's the one, he said. Do not make life so difficult for us under a perpetually nervous Soviet leadership. And most everyone I know who has dealt with the Soviets believes that that is not the way to go. That the way to go is quietly, forcefully, of course, but without fanfare. The trouble is, as we all know, that doesn't always suit politicians at home. Let me raise a question. Has our public pressure on the Soviet Union regarding Andrei Sakharov done very much to help him? I think it makes us feel terrific to name a street outside the Soviet embassy in Washington in his honor, but I think we all know that in this media society it does not take long for Andrei Sakharov to drop from view. Where is he now? What is his present state of health? Do you remember how enamored we are when we got our hands on some photographs some months ago? He has disappeared from sight, I think at least in the consciousness of most Americans today. I don't want to paint altogether too black a picture about our pressure, except perhaps to make you think about it. It is true that for dissidents in the Soviet Union, our public spotlight has been in many ways the nourishment that has kept them going. But it is also true that our concentration on the dissidents has tended to make us ignore the larger group of Soviet citizens who very often find the dissidents, whether they be political or religious, to be troublemakers and treasonous. That the control may come from the police apparatus in the Soviet Union, but the general reluctance to support the dissidents in the Soviet Union is pretty absent. If you take violence in a society as something of a benchmark as to how deeply the society is troubled, as we saw, for example, in Poland, as we saw in Hungary and Czechoslovakia in 56 and 68, then based on what we know today, the Soviet society is not in any danger whatsoever of unraveling, as we are often told by our politicians. I think what concerns me most as the United States and the Soviet Union sit down again to try to seriously negotiate arms control is our intentions. There's no doubt that our goal should be to contain the Soviets. But I don't find much value in a sometimes abiding passion here to humiliate the Soviets. To contain is possible. To agree is desirable and certainly possible. But to humiliate seems to me somewhat of a pointless exercise. Let's take the Middle East for just a second. The Soviets have humiliated, have suffered three devastating humiliations by their client state since 1967. And what is the principal element of concern vis-a-vis the superpowers in the Middle East today? It is the American humiliation in Lebanon, which has sort of cast the tone of the Middle East for the foreseeable future. President Carter confused the hell out of the Soviet leadership. President Reagan makes them angry. So we are never quite certain, I think, as citizens, which way we're going to go. It is true when the United States is firm, the Soviets tend to back off. But that is different from programs which somehow set out to punish. When Yuri Andropov said, and I find his quote, "Those who try to infringe on Soviet independence will end up on the garbage heap of history," we may not agree with him, but he is speaking what I think is an essential Russian truth. In the last 4 years, I think we have made the mistake of overestimating the Soviets' vulnerabilities. We pictured the Soviet Union as a feeble giant. There is no evidence. There is trouble on the horizon, certainly, but there is no chaos. We firmly believe that with the deployment of the Pershing and cruise missiles in Western Europe, that we had corralled our allies in the face of a determined Soviet propaganda campaign. True enough, but the Soviets today can also point to the major opposition party in West Germany, which is now committed to any further deployment of Pershing and reversing the decision if it ever comes into power, and can point to all of the major opposition parties in Great Britain, to principally, who are all committed now to a radical review of NATO's nuclear policy, and the Labour Party particularly committed to not having an American nuclear presence on British soil. I think what I'm trying to say is that the Soviets can only be blamed for so much. They can't be blamed for everything that is happening in Central America, for all of the debt in the developing world, and for the growing disparity between and disenchantment between rich and poor. Are there possibilities for real change in the Soviet Union? I suggest there is no possibility for chaos, and I think little chance for change except a Soviet leadership fails to see and fails to deal with a genuinely popular uprising in Eastern Europe, which is going to infect the motherland. Unless the Soviet military feels the civilian leadership is not meeting urgent national needs, And unless a dangerous non-nuclear confrontation somewhere in the world with the United States so undermines the Soviet leadership that it cannot function. Now, all of these seem to me to be fairly remote possibilities. Many, many Soviet policies can be questioned and should be questioned by us. But survival of the Soviet system, I would suggest to you, is not in question. Thank you very much.
We now have an opportunity for questions. I've been assured that everything is fair game, not just the Soviet Union.
There's a British politician named Enoch Powell, who some of you may have heard of, who comes from Northern Ireland. And I gave a lunch for him once in London. He was very famous for his pronouncements on race. And I gave a lunch, and he said, I'm going to tell you about the British and the Northern Ireland. I'm going to tell you about the British economy, and you will sit down and ask me questions about race, which we did. So as Jim points out, I will try to answer your questions, not guarantee I can.
Yes. You have said that the American media coverage of the Soviet Union is very bad. And I'm wondering if maybe you could bring some of your criticism closer to home on your own ABC News program. I'll try to mention two quick examples. I know your esteemed colleague, the lovable George Will, often makes commentaries on the Soviet Union. One example that I can mention is he's mentioned no less than six times in the last year on your show, Ted Koppel's and David Brinkley's show, that the Soviets are responsible for yellow rain in Afghanistan and Southeast Asia. Now, several scientific teams have gone to study this, and they've all concluded that this is not caused by the Soviet Union. And so you often, I think, show great deference to George Will whenever he makes a comment like this. Like, this is objective truth. A second example I'll give real quickly is the coverage of World War II. We've had all these anniversary demonstrations recently where it's shown where Great Britain, France, and the United States gets together to celebrate Normandy and what have you. And whenever the Soviets complain that, you know, they had 20 million people who gave their lives during World War II, it's always a quick quotation from Pravda. Like, and whenever you say Pravda on your news broadcast, that immediately signals to the Americans that that's just nonsense and propaganda. I just say I'd like you to respond to those two examples and possibly answer that in the 1940s, the media and the movie industry portrayed the Soviet Union
Please make the question brief.
Okay. In a very positive light. China was portrayed very positively in the 1970s when before they were the yellow peril. My question is, do you think that American attitudes toward the Soviet Union would change if the media perhaps gave the same treatment that China is given today?
Yes. But I do want, gosh, it's hard to defend yourself against, first of all, I don't intend to defend George. I disagree with him as often as you do. And often violently. No. But George is a commentator for ABC, and I want you to understand that. And I am not a commentator, and as often as I'd like to take him on, George is hired by my company to offer commentary and to inflame people like you. and me as well. And I'm uncomfortable when you say that I appear sometimes to defer to you, to defer to George. I will guard against even giving the appearance of deferring to him. As for the question of us quoting Pravda and not perhaps concentrating enough on Soviet participation in World War II, I think it's a good point. I think we paid quite a lot of attention to it during the celebrations at Normandy. I think that when you say that if we use the word Pravda, it is something of a buzzword for the American people, I think that is perhaps true, but I don't think we do it in that particular respect. Pravda is a legitimate, powerful source of official information for us, and one of the great difficulties we have in covering the Soviet Union on a more comprehensive way, of course, is the whole question of secrecy. So Pravda is available to us, Novosti is available to us, TASS is available to us. So I don't mean to denigrate, if I quote Pravda, I don't mean to denigrate it in any way, because it represents the point of view. But I take your point in general, that if the American media were more exploratory in general terms, and perhaps as excited about breaking down the barriers of the Soviet Union as we have indeed been about China, in part because of access, in part because of a deeper mystery, then you and we would have a better understanding of it. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I'm curious what your opinion is regarding the question of projections in presidential elections before polls have closed, and whether you think networks should do that, and what effect you think it has on national elections.
Well, let me go backwards with you. I don't think it has any effect on national elections. And there is no empirical data anywhere in the country to show that network projections have had any serious dilatory effect on election races. I was on the record all through the election year within my own company as saying I'm opposed to projections until polls are closed. And I don't know if you've noticed, but all three of the networks have recently reached an agreement with Congress by which we will not project election results until the polls are closed in states. In return, hopefully, Congress will work for a universal poll closing time so that the problem of having information and not reporting it will go away. But I was opposed to it. I was opposed to using exit polls to project results. And so as far as I'm concerned, I won. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Jennings, do you have any hope that Mr. Gorbachev, if indeed he becomes the head of the Soviet Union within the next few years, even next few months, may change the situation via the dissidents of the Jewish population in the Soviet Union to any appreciable extent and be perhaps another Khrushchev in a sense, or don't you think that'll happen at all?
Well, let me tell you just how deeply self-conscious I am about saying anything about a succession in the Soviet Union at the moment, because we made absolute, forgive my language, horses' asses of ourselves on the question of Yuri Andropov's succession. We had him as a whiskey-swilling, jazz-listening, English-speaking liberal, and I'm talking about the media in general now, which completely had forgotten that he had spent virtually his entire adult career in the KGB. Once again, I think we are making an essential mistake, which is to see Gorbachev come to London, for example, and I think it's purely deliberate by the Soviets, having a sort of high, westernized, if you will, profile, in order that we might think in a particular vein about him. As to how he will treat with the dissidents, as to how he will treat with the Jewish population, I have no idea. I think Jewish emigration will continue to depend to a considerable extent on U.S.-Soviet relations, as it has in the past. But I would—I haven't the vaguest idea.
Could he be as much of a departure, do you think, as some people hope that he would be? Or, is there a reason to think that he might really be a great departure from what's happened up to now?
Well, really sort of what we have to go on is he's younger. He is seen, as is Romanov seen to some extent, as being sort of the new generation, the end of that particular age group of Brezhnev, Khrushchev. But I must tell you that at this point, that's really as much as we have to go on. We have no idea how he will behave. But the other thing we have to remember is it's a very collective Soviet leadership. You know, we're all fascinated with Mr. Chernyenko's health, but the Soviet Union does appear to continue able to pursue its foreign policy goals and its domestic policy goals to some extent, even though Mr. Chernyenko is desperately ill. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Jennings, you see our sanctions and our pressure on the Soviet Union as ineffective to some degree, and I agree, and also that our efforts at humiliation are misguided. What sort of strategy of containment do you foresee as being in any way successful, and how do you feel about more active measures that involve military pressure, such as the grenade invasion or perhaps stepped up supplies to the Afghani rebels?
Let me just talk about Grenada briefly. I don't know how I feel about Grenada. To be honest, some days I think it was like invading Club Med. And I am one of those who does not really feel that you should be using American power around the world where it isn't necessary to use American power around the world. You ask about how we contain the Soviets. I can tell you only this from my own point of view. I'm somewhat troubled now about the direction the administration appears to be going in Nicaragua. Not that I'm a supporter of the Sandinistas or anything else, but it seems to me that if we wish to solve what we believe to be a Soviet or Soviet-Cuban problem in terms of Nicaragua, there are other ways to deal with it beside the Contras. If, and the administration, as you know, subtly changed, or not so subtly changed its attitude at the moment from democratization to to getting rid of the Sandinistas altogether with the president's speech last week and Secretary of State's testimony this week. It seems to me there is a way to deal with the Soviets at the source about what we will accept and what we will not accept in terms of our overall relationship, in terms of support for Nicaragua. Some of you will have heard, and I don't be outraged by having George Wilhurd say on the air the other night that we should, you know, openly go in and overthrow the government of Nicaragua. If we are so concerned that what is behind this is, in fact, yet another Soviet attempt to extend its influence in the hemisphere, we are now dealing in, or about to deal again in Geneva, with arms control, with Star Wars. I am a firm believer in this kind of linkage. But if the Soviets want to make progress on arms control, then we have to, at the very same time, talk to them about Central America. And that it is not simply necessary, I'm not saying it's totally unnecessary, but the way to go about it is simply to fight over whether or not we will give weapons to the Contras. I think we're going to try to make some progress in the Middle East as well. We have long, as you know, resisted to an all-party conference in the Middle East. We have long resisted having any internationalization of negotiations in the Middle East about a general settlement. But I, quite frankly, don't see how you can get an overall Middle East settlement unless the Soviets play some more active role in it, because they always have the capacity to spoil it.
I wondered what your attitude was to put it on Washington in the A Harvard professor told me that there's talk in Washington in the anti-abortion groups of using the film The Silent Scream or The Secret Scream, whatever it's called.
Silent Scream.
In terms of trying to use this film to put it on national TV to re-energize the abortion debate. And I wondered what your attitude was towards this film and towards putting this film on ABC News, or towards allowing coverage of this film and its impact?
Well, national television, Silent Scream has been on national television in a variety of ways already. It was shown, I think, last weekend on the Superstation in Atlanta, which reaches quite a wide section of the population, though I don't know how many people saw it. We have all used small portions of Silent Scream, based on the fact that the Reagan White House allowed a White House auditorium to be used to screen it for a lot of anti-abortion people. So it became quite a subject of controversy, at least on our own program, one night, and we had a discussion as to whether or not this fetus really was feeling pain, whether this was a legitimate film. The tendency among most of the medical community we talked to was that it was not. But I think that the anti-abortion movement has clearly made a very brilliant public relations move here by managing to introduce this film into the debate. Now, if they ever came to ABC and said, would ABC sell them time to show it at length on the network, I think almost inevitably ABC's answer would be no.
What would your response be if President Reagan made a personal appeal to the networks to say, have him...
I'd say no even louder. Yes,
Mr. Jennings, you had mentioned earlier the Soviet Union's inability or choice within change within their own country, and especially those Eastern Bloc countries. How effective do you think the Soviet Union will remain in being able to take control, especially with Romania coming to the Olympics, and I think the rest of the country has witnessed the oppression of Poland? How effective do you think the Soviet Union will be able to keep control of their Soviet Bloc countries?
Somebody remind me, how many Soviet divisions are there in Hungary? I've forgotten. How many Soviet divisions are there in Poland? How many Soviet divisions are there in Romania? Let me try to give you a personal idea of it. I mean, sort of on-the-ground idea rather than a sort of an attempted analytical idea. In Poland, when Solidarity was absolutely at its height, we were desperately concerned in this country that the Soviets were going to invade. And so reporters like myself were all dispatched to stand in the freezing cold of downtown Warsaw a couple of years ago to do stories on the Soviet invasion, which of course didn't occur. I get the sense in Eastern Europe and in Central Europe, and I say Central Europe, I include Hungary, that there is a very keen awareness in every case as to how much you can alter the system and how far you can go, given that you live inside a Soviet sphere of influence, inside a container. One of the things about solidarity that I think we didn't understand in this country was there was never any intention by any of the leadership in solidarity, whether it was the old line Baltic exchange workers or the new Lech Wałęsa, was to wrench Poland outside, to wrench Poland away from the socialist system. I don't know any dissident or any opposition politician in any socialist country in Eastern or Central Europe who does not believe that they will have to continue to live within the defined post-World War II borders as agreed essentially at Yalta. Flexibility, yes, we see it in Hungary. But if the coal miners, for example, in Czechoslovakia are in danger of infecting what I called earlier the motherland, then the Soviets just simply get doubly nervous. And that's what makes them nervous. What worries them most is infection, I think. As for the countries themselves, I think they are not content, perhaps, but resigned to living the way they have always lived since 1945.
Do you think the American media sometimes portrays solidarity as more, you know, in a sense it is a communist kind of trade union? Do you think that American media sometimes portrays that to get people in the United States feeling an empathy for the Polish people?
No, I mean, I think we make a basic mistake in our society. It's not, and our media is a reflection of it, which is to say we tend to see the rest of the world in terms of personalities. You're going to, may I suggest for those of you who come, a question for Jihan Sadat, who I know very well, as I lived with the Sadats for some time and made a film about his life. Ask her why Americans were so stunned when he was assassinated and nobody in Egypt reacted. And the answer to that is I think, simple in Egypt, as it was with Lech Wałęsa in Poland, as is with our present fascination with individual Soviet leaders, is we become so wrapped up in the personalities of people that we forget to see the trends. When Anwar Sadat was assassinated, couldn't have had a quieter time in Egypt. And Barbara Walters and I sat there doing the narrations and the commentary for the funeral. And here's Barbara saying, "We've lost a great American hero," and I say, "We've lost a great Egyptian failure." We must have just confused the hell out of the audience. So, I mean, I think it's a great American failing. I don't think it's going to change particularly either. Yes, sir.
Early in your remarks, you mentioned two superpowers. Yesterday, in Margaret Thatcher's remarks before a joint session of Congress, she seemed to be underscoring the possibility of an independent third superpower being formed or arising out of the countries of Europe and a united Europe. First of all, I'd like to ask you whether you see both the inclinations and the capability of doing that in Western European nations today.
No.
No.
That's a very simple answer. Margaret Thatcher is running for re-election. Though a bit early, and I think that she used the opportunity of the joint meeting of Congress to say to give a sense of sort of global Margaret Thatcher speech. I think the chance of a European power emerging now, other than a united Germany, which is many years, if ever, down the road, I see no opportunity for a sort of central thing to grow out of France and Britain and Belgium and Italy and Holland and West Germany.
Let me make the second question moot, but if you could just treat it as a hypothetical, if it were to arise, do you think it would be a very positive influence in terms of U.S.-Soviet relations, having another actor in the picture equally powerful?
It is so hypothetical, I haven't, to be honest, really thought about it. I mean, I think it is very important that the various of our allies and various of theirs, but let's take ours primarily, you know, have an effect on the sort of dynamic of the superpower relationship. I think the German attitudes towards the relationship are very important, much more important, for example, than I think the British are. I'm a firm believer in a strong Germany, because there is a different realization and a different sense about what a superpower relationship is if you live next door to one than if you live as far away as we do. I suppose in general terms think we should be more susceptible at times to the attitudes of our allies in order to have a more leavened relationship, one other than one which rises and falls sometimes with such rapidity. One day we hate the Russians, the next day, you know, we go from evil empire to let's talk over a fairly short period of time. This confuses, I think, not only the Soviets, but it confuses our allies as well.
I hate to pass up the opportunity to ask you a third question based on your answer.
Sorry, we really do have a number of people waiting. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry. Mr. Jennings, what drives the focus of a network news program? What's going on in South Africa is nothing new, and yet recently the situation has risen to the fore, and I rather strongly suspect that it will soon recede to the rather remote mm-hmm. background. Is there an attempt to follow the public interest, or is there a recognition that the media leads public interest? And if that's the case, then who's making these determinations of in which directions it's going to be led and on what criteria?
Well, in some respects, everything you've said is accurate. Because often the media does, I think, lead public opinion, and sometimes it responds to public opinion. You're quite right that what's been going on in South Africa has been going on at least since 1976 in terms of the major demonstrations that we've had. And the more militant nature of the black South African movement. I think what got it going this time was, is it Randall Robinson? Forgotten his first name, Max Robinson's brother. Who began this long series of protests outside the South African embassy. We didn't pay much attention to them at the beginning because there's somebody protesting outside some embassy every day. But as that began to catch fire and more political figures, for one reason or another, began to associate with us, yes, I think people said, hold it, we're doing all these demonstrations. How long is it since we've had a reporter in South Africa? So then you get reporters in South Africa. Now you have a new wave of demonstrations in Cape Town, for example, about relocating essentially indigenous South African blacks as opposed to homeland blacks, and that works back the other way. You get pressure in the Congress at the same time, pressure on American corporations to rewrite the Sullivan Act. You get some controversy going about whether or not the president's policy of negotiation or engagement with the South Africans is better than economic sanctions. And these things do all tend to impact or interact at least with one another. You are absolutely right, sadly, but you're absolutely right, that it will fade. It will recede, I think, in an undetermined period of time, and we will then get concerned again about Poland or Nicaragua or Honduras or whatever. But it will also come back again. There's no way to explain the rise and fall of the rhythms of daily general national news coverage.
If I might have a brief follow-up, what I'm more interested in is the fact that the news media does, to some extent, lead public interest in certain directions, and who's making those determinations and what criteria they use it.
Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you that I make some of them. I'll give you an example. We became fascinated with Ethiopia and famine in Ethiopia. And about 4 or 5 days ago, I just said to myself, we haven't had a reporter in Ethiopia for a long time. You know, are we letting the story fall off the edge? Is this television again, you know, going in and milking it for all it's worth and capturing the American imagination and doing one story after another about dead women and kids? And that's sort of what happens. Somebody in the office, it could be me, it could be lots of other people, who says, conscience is working here, have we let this go? So we send a reporter back to Ethiopia. But things do come and go. Things do come and go. We have 22 minutes a night to present the news. And you can imagine what it's like competing to get on that news. Foreign news has always, rather sadly, taken second place just historically to domestic news in terms of the national television newscasts. So it's quite a fight, particularly with the kind of issues you're mentioning, to get them on the air. Sorry.
Have you given any thought to specific activities which the media can undertake to improve relations with the Soviet Union, perhaps pet projects which you have considered but haven't had time to pursue?
Well, I'm not sure it's a question of whether we improve relations with the Soviet Union. I don't really think our job is to play a role in improving relations as a deliberate thing. But we try to do quite a lot of broadcasting again, to come back to this gentleman's question, on a more occasional basis than we should about Soviet American affairs. I recently did, and we won some awards for it, which rather pleased me, a 10-part series on Soviet American affairs that ran for 2 weeks. NBC has recently done quite a lot of good broadcasting. We all tended to do quite a lot when we all went overseas and got very interested on the whole question of Soviet American arms control. And so we concentrate on this for a long period of time. The WIC experiment with the USIA trying to beam American broadcasting into the Soviet Union, I think, is probably somewhat more intended as a contentious thing than it is intended to be an exchange of information. People in the developing world, and I include the Soviets here in this one instance, are always complaining that they can't get their views exposed in America. Well, the answer is fairly simple. Most broadcasting, most media in developing countries in the world, as it is in the Soviet Union, are state-supported systems. And what goes on is what the state decides at a political and cultural level they want to go on. We work for businesses in this country. And so, you know, you're competing with Cheers and Hill Street Blues. And I don't know that the Soviet Union sells dentifrice or soap. Sad, but it's the reality of the kind of society we live in. Yes, sir.
You spoke of the fact that the media doesn't at many times seem to present the broader picture of Soviet life and Soviet culture to the American public, that they carry a lot of cultural baggage. But if you're a journalist in the Soviet Union, your real opportunities for exploring it are very limited. I mean, there's due to the paranoia, or at least the love of secrecy and security, which you mentioned, it's very difficult for officially connected people from the outside.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree with you at all. It is extremely difficult for foreign correspondents to work in the Soviet Union. And depending on the climate of the relationship between the two countries, more or less difficult. But it isn't impossible.
No, it's not.
And what we need to do is to simply, at the sort of producers, executive producers, presidents, managing editors level, and print does it better than television, is to make a wider commitment to letting reporters go off and spend the expense of 3 weeks in Siberia to do something on the pipeline, or to go to the Muslim, communities and live with them. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the Soviets are going to allow us the freedom to wander around.
Well,
I think
sometimes
we could do a great deal more within the confines that we face.
Another thing, point that you touched on, was the return of Svetlana Aleyeva, return of Jewish immigrants to Russia, which sort of surprises some Americans.
I'll say that.
But, of course, you have to understand, there is Mother Russia. They have that kind of attachment and that kind of relationship with their country, which we do not have. We don't have a real mother love kind of relationship with this country. I mean, and I think that perhaps the media
Sorry,
could do.
Sorry, we really are here to hear Mr. Okay. Jennings.
No, I mean, I'm delighted to hear you, because I think you make a very. I apologize.
Yeah, Bob.
Okay. Sorry.
But I think I've
been lucky enough to travel the length and breadth of Soviet Union, much to the surprise of Soviet immigrants whom I encounter here. They can't believe that an American has been where I've been.
I think you make a very good point. I talked a little bit about this with Tashka, there is an enormous Russian attachment to the land. One of the things we've got to get over, and we still have reporters, it drives me crazy, who call the place Russia.
Right. It's
and they forget that, you know.
They'll tell you they're Soviets, no matter where,
right.
Where you are. Now, one last thing. The reason I was talking about this is, one of the things I find is there is a reluctance of many Americans to even go to the Soviet Union, even if they have the opportunity. There's often a reluctance, especially among our ethnic population, the people who are descendants from the East European countries. They have this vendetta mentality. They have this revenge thing which has been inculcated into them, which definitely affects our foreign policy. And the opportunity is given them. They come from a free country where they can go there and at least see what is going on. But they're always reluctant because they've been brainwashed. If any of the people in this audience get a chance, they should go, because hopefully they have their own mind and their free mind. They won't be influenced adversely,
I couldn't agree with you more. Couldn't agree with you more. There's nothing like going and seeing. Yes, ma'am.
Last question. I'm sorry.
This will be very quick. Thank you for your remarks about the Soviet Union, because I was there as a student at one time, and I was amazed at the mixture of pride and paranoia, but the love for peace. How everybody, people my age, remembered this great patriotic war, and people wore medals, and brides and grooms went to the monuments in the towns and put their flowers there, all this. But then they would say to me, we have to have these weapons because you Americans are so aggressive. When I came back and said that to people, they said, well, you're being fooled. It's not the students anyway who would make the war. It's the Soviet leaders. What do you see as a way to break through this this military establishment, or a way that on a level, a personal level, people can really work for peace when the establishment there does seem to be as much involved as we are in the kind of military
establishment? I think it would not behoove me, madam, to start giving advice on how to interact with the Soviets, nor would I want to be seen as deferring to your remark that we are run by a military establishment. It's interesting. I get a lot of letters on the subject from people. I recently had an ad sent to me by the Vancouver Columbian, which is a newspaper in northern Oregon or northern Washington State. And a lot of people in that town had just simply got together and written a letter to the Soviet Union, somewhat more sophisticated than Samantha Smith's. But there was clearly an urge with some Americans to try to reach out and somehow interact at less than the bureaucratic level. But I think it would not behoove me to give people advice on how to do it. Yes, sir. You've been standing there for a bit.
Mr. Jennings, you have spoken of what you see as the durability of the Soviet state. But despite this, do you think that communism as an ideology is a terminal case?
I don't know, which is the sort of gut answer I can give you. If the Sandinistas, to pick one, have embraced a measure of communism, or if the prisoners at Auschwitz during the Second World War embraced a measure of communism, there is no guarantee it will last. Do I agree that overall communism is a terminal case? I have no idea. Is Cuba a communist state or is it a socialist state? Is Poland going to continue to be run by communists? Will Hungary, for all of its freedom, continue to be run by communists? I haven't the vaguest idea whether it's a terminal case. Do you?
I think it's getting pretty close.
Okay. I mean, I defer to your opinion, obviously.
Well, unfortunately, we're required to get Mr. James to the airport. So join with me in thanking him for joining us.
Thank you very much.